Welcome to a special edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Jim Roberts, president of the American Veterans Center, sitting in for Gene Pell. Our guest this week is General Richard B. Myers, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and co-author of Eyes on the Horizon, serving on the front lines of national security. A 40-year veteran of the United States Air Force, General Myers has held commands at every level, including Commander U.S. Space Command, NORAD, Pacific Air Forces, U.S. Forces Japan, and two fighter wings. He began his career as a fighter pilot, logging several thousand hours with more than 600 combat hours in Vietnam. General Myers capped off his career by serving as the 15th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the critical years following the attacks on September 11, 2001. Since his retirement in 2005, he has served on a number of public and nonprofit boards and holds the Colin Powell Chair of Leadership, Ethics, and Character at the National Defense University. He has also been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian award. Our conversation begins with the events of September 11, 2001, just a few weeks before he was set to be confirmed as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I was on my way to Capitol Hill to meet with Senator Max Cleland, one of the senators from Georgia, and it was prior to my confirmation as chairman. You go around, you meet all the senators on the Armed Services Committee, make sure that if they have any issues, hopefully you can resolve them in face-to-face meetings. And I had been nominated to be the chairman, but I was the vice chairman at the time. The chairman, Hugh Shelton, was on his way to a NATO meeting, so he was not there.
And so that made you the acting chairman?
I was the acting chairman. So when I walked into Senator Cleland's office on the TV there, this was a little before 9 o'clock, I think our appointment was for, on East Coast time, walked in, and there on the TV was the pictures of the first tower in flames, World Trade Center Tower. And the newscasters were saying, we don't know, we think a plane hit it, but there was a lot of uncertainty about what had happened. So I think to myself, this is such a clear day out here on the East Coast. How could any pilot, and being a pilot, said, how could any pilot be so stupid as to run into the World Trade Center? But it didn't click yet that it might have been
right. Intentional.
So going to the meeting, a few minutes later, the second tower's hit. We know something's up, so come out. And I'm soon on the phone with the North American Aerospace Defense Commander, General Ed Eberhardt, talking about actions we're going to take to clear the airways, land all the airliners, and sort this out. As I get ready to go to my car and leave Capitol Hill, the driver says, sir, I just got a call from the office. The Pentagon's been hit. And I said, oh, my goodness. So we've had World Trade Center, now the Pentagon. And so we rush back from Capitol Hill across the Potomac River, look at the Pentagon there, and there's this black smoke and flames rolling out of it. And you can't even tell what part's been hit. I wasn't sure whether it was the side of the building where our offices were or where exactly it was. It turned out it was on the opposite side of the building of where our offices were, where Secretary Rumsfeld's offices were, and where a lot of the senior folks in the Pentagon, they picked the other side to hit. And I don't know if they picked it or that's just the way it worked out. And people were evacuating because the building was on fire. It's
right.
A big building, so fire alarms were going off, lots of people coming out. Helicopters had landed to take a lot of the staff to an alternate site, which was part of our continuity of government plan. And I asked my military assistant who was still in the building, I said, is the National Military Command Center up and functioning? He said, yes, it is. I said, well, that's where I need to go. I need to go where we have people that are used to dealing with these things. We have our checklist to go through, and I need to go there so I can start communicating and finding out what's going on and how we need to react. So it was almost surreal, you know, walking back in a building where you could smell smoke. We weren't in any danger, of course, where we were, but there was smoke in the corridors. The fire alarm was constantly going off in your ears. We got in the National Military Command Center. It was a lot quieter in there, and it was business as usual. We had a great team doing, as you would imagine, and just marching down the checklist of things to do and coordinating all the various responses and taking all the information in.
As you write in the book, the atmosphere in the city was somewhat chaotic in the sense that Secretary Powell, I think, was in South America. The chairman was on his way to Europe. President Bush was in Florida. How did the response team get pulled together in this environment?
Well, it was a little chaotic because there were one of the first reports was that there was a bomb had gone off in front of the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
I remember that.
We thinking, okay, is the whole city under attack? Turned out that was not a correct report. And then we dealt with reports all day long about other aircraft that were inbound, and particularly international aircraft. we could land all the aircraft here in the United States, but we had some inbound aircraft that had to continue on towards the United States, could not be turned around, and we had to assure ourselves that they were not a threat as well. And then with the president gone, of course, the vice president and national security advisor and assistant national security advisor, they were worried the White House was the target. So they had to go to an alternate location in the White House. But we had good communications between everybody. It was a little – we were a little slow. The communications with the FAA were not perfect at first, particularly between the FAA and North American Aerospace Defense Command out in Colorado Springs. But eventually that all got worked out pretty well. So we're on what we call a threat conference, and mm-hmm. we kept that open for a long time as we're trying to decide what to do.
Now, Secretary Rumsfeld was in the building, in fact, when it was hit, correct?
He was in the building when it was hit, and his initial instinct was to go out and help. So he went outside the building, walked around the building to the side where the airplane impacted the building, and he was out helping people manage the scene out there and helping survivors and helping with triage. And so when I got to the National Military Command Center, I said, you know, where's the secretary? He said, well, he's outside helping. So he came in. As I recall, he came in with a white shirt, sleeves rolled up like he had been working, and he came in fairly quickly after I got there because he soon realized, well, there's enough people out here to help. I need to get back. And then we started the work of trying to figure out, okay, who did it? What's going to happen next? Are there going to be more attacks? And how do we protect the American citizen, and how do we protect our military forces, not only in the United States but around the world? Is this part of a larger attack on our forces or our interest around the world? So we started that ball rolling.
Of course, there was a great deal of uncertainty still at that point. I recall that the president did not return to Washington right away. He went, I forget where it was, Colorado? Were you part of that decision?
He went. I was not part of that decision. They were. That was a White House decision on where he would go. But he eventually wound up in Omaha, Nebraska at Offutt Air Force Base at our Strategic Air Command headquarters. And I remember we had a video teleconference with the president from that location. Again, there was so much uncertainty. Are there more attacks coming?
Right.
If he comes back to the White House, is our head of state vulnerable? So he went to Omaha for a while, but then came back to Washington later that afternoon.
That afternoon, right. And the chairman returned when?
He returned that afternoon as well. I think 5 or 5:30, he's back in the saddle and
okay.
in charge. And I'd been working everything all day, but as he came back, as I remember, Senators Levin and Warner came over to the Pentagon, and they went down to a press conference with Secretary Rumsfeld, the two senators, and General Shelton. And I wasn't needed at that, so I went on and did other things at that point.
Okay. You write in the book that driving back to the Pentagon and seeing this black plume of smoke arising from the building brought back a memory from your early boyhood that seared into your memory. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was 2 years old, and obviously I don't remember a lot about this, but I know the incident because it's pretty well recorded by the parents. When I was 2 years old, 1944, World War II was going on. A B-24 loaded with fuel headed towards Europe eventually. The pilot decided to go fly over his parents' home, and it was about two or three blocks away from where I lived, and it crashed. And I can remember the airplane falling out of the sky, the crash, and the black smoke again.
Right.
And I don't remember the flames necessarily. So the impact that had on me was every time I saw an airplane, I'd run in the house crying.
Right.
And it was starting to just concern my parents, so they took me down to this doctor we'd been using, a family practitioner, and full of common sense, which is not uncommon for those folks there in the Midwest. And he said, well, what's Dick like to do? He says, well, he likes to eat. And that was probably true. I still like to eat. So he said, well, take him down to our Kansas City airport, and you can sit in the restaurant there. He can eat, which is something he likes to do, and he can watch the airplanes, and maybe he'll get used to that. And lo and behold, it obviously worked because I took a flight on a TWA plane from Kansas City to Wichita. It was kind of the end of my therapy after I'd gorged myself on hamburgers at the local airport or whatever they were feeding me in those days, and of course became a pilot. So,
yeah. What great advice from that doctor, though.
You know? It was wonderful, and I can almost remember his name. I think it starts with a W, but I mean, he was his family ought to be proud because he just put some old common sense on it, and it worked.
Exactly. Should mention to our listeners that this took place in Kansas. You grew up in Kansas.
Grew up in the Kansas City area, right?
Right.
On the Kansas side, right.
Like another general that one could mention, General Eisenhower, who said he had the great privilege of growing up in a small town
in Abilene, Kansas. And General Eisenhower, people said, well, who are your heroes? And General Eisenhower always comes to the forefront for me because he served in a very selfless way. During World War II, General Marshall wanted him to do all the major planning for D-Day and all that business. And so he was stuck in the Pentagon as all his peers were going off and getting these great commands.
Right.
And he privately lamented that, well, I'm really disappointed I'm not in the front lines as a combat commander. But if they want me to plan here in Washington, I'll do that. And then, of course, before it was all over, they made him the supreme commander of all our forces. And he performed magnificently and, of course, was later president.
Indeed. Tell us a bit about your mother and your father and the influence they had on you.
Well, they were, I'd say, no nonsense, no frills. We had a good upbringing. Because of the Depression, Mom had to take care of her parents, so she couldn't get married because her parents lost a grocery store they had during the Depression. And it gave out too much credit. People mm-hmm. didn't pay back. They finally lost the business. So they got married late in life, and they didn't think they could have children. Then I came along, and then 2 years later, my brother came along. I think my mom was 39 when she had me and 41 when she had my brother. And back in those days, that was pretty old to be having children. So they really doted on us, I would say. I mean, they were strict disciplinarians, but at the same time, there's nothing they wouldn't do for us. And my mom would sacrifice everything for her two sons and dad as well. So it was a very nurturing, very caring environment. And I think in many ways, growing up in that time frame was idyllic. I mean, we had World War II going on, so we had our garden back and all that sort of stuff, and we were saving papers and bacon fat, all those things that we were asked to do, and medals. But having said that, that growing up in that time frame was almost idyllic. And I think I couldn't have asked for better parents. They were wonderful.
Now, in high school, I know you played a lot of sports, but before that, your mother was absolutely determined that you were going to learn music and appreciate it. And so you had some lessons, right?
She did. She we had lessons. The problem would have been solved if we hadn't had the piano right next to a big picture window in our house where I could look out and see everybody else playing outside, and I'm in there practicing. But I love that part because I still play the piano. I'm not very good. But I still play. I was able to play in a band in high school, and then later on in college, we had a little rock band, and it made enough money to pay for my books and incidentals at school while my parents covered the tuition. So it was. I mean, I'm glad she did. And then I eventually took up the saxophone after that as part of the rock band deal. So.
All right, General, we have to pause for a brief commercial break. We'll be right back.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Jim Roberts, and my guest today is General Richard Myers, and we're talking about his book, Eyes on the Horizon, a memoir of his life in the military. General, before the break, we've gotten through your high school education experience, sports, music, the fact you learned to play the saxophone, which paid off later when you went to college at Kansas State, I believe.
You bet.
And you were in a rock band there, which came as a great surprise to me.
Don't look like a rocker. It was a way to earn money. And in mm-hmm. those days, we got $10 a piece for a gig. And it doesn't sound like much, but in the early 60s, that was actually quite a bit. I can remember cashing a dollar check at the local drugstore and getting a sandwich, getting a drink, and getting change back. So $10 went quite a ways in those days. gasoline, I think it was 20-some cents a gallon. So, I mean, but it was not only fun. It's just really fun to make music. I think I'm a frustrated musician at heart. I wish I were a lot better at it because I like music, all kinds of music, and I, you know, wish I'd, just maybe that had been a career if I hadn't right. gone into ROTC. But it was a great thing to do during college, as I said, to earn that money and help out with expenses.
Right. Ed, you mentioned ROTC, which was, I think, obligatory at Kansas State.
It was obligatory, and I quip sometimes that I'm really a draft dodger because I went in. ROTC was mandatory for the first 2 years, optional by the time I got there for the second year, junior and senior year. I elected to take it because I didn't mind serving. I just didn't want to be drafted. Mm-hmm. I wanted a little bit more say in where I might go off to. And, I mean, I picked Air Force ROTC. I don't know why I picked the Air Force over the Army. They had the two programs there. Maybe they had the shorter line the day I enrolled. I mean, there was nobody in my family had served. I had an uncle who had served in World War II, but that was pretty far removed. My parents, nobody real close had served. So, you know, I was kind of making my own way here. But went in the Air Force ROTC program, and when I really caught fire was when they taught me to fly as part of the ROTC program, and I earned my private license there in Manhattan, Kansas, and that turned everything around for me. I just loved flying, and so it spurred on not only my interest in ROTC and getting a commission eventually, but also in my other schoolwork. I mean, it just kind of fired me up, and it was gave me a real sense of purpose.
Another extremely important development, of course, at Kansas State was that you met your future wife, Mary Jo.
I did, and we met, I think, my sophomore year, and were eventually married right before I went off to pilot training in the University Chapel there on the Kansas State University campus. And we've been married now for coming up on 45 years here, 44, I'm sorry, this summer.
I had the pleasure of meeting Mary Jo a few years ago, and I don't need to tell you how lucky you are. What a lovely lady, intelligent, lovely, personable, a tremendous asset, I'm sure, to your
career. I don't think I do it justice in the book in explaining what she meant to me, because who knows where I'd have wound up if it hadn't been for my best friend and a good critic, too, and somebody that keeps you level-headed mm-hmm. as you go through the ranks. I mean, she would never let me, best she could, be arrogant or try to be infatuated with the position that we had. She was always well-grounded, kept me well-grounded, as do my children. They never give me any slack either. And that's all I think you need people like that around you. She's very down to earth. She works very hard. She's devoting a lot of her time now mainly to military charities and organizations that help the troops. She still does that, and she's very good at that.
Yeah. One of your predecessors, Admiral Moore, told me on this program, he said, they say that a good wife can make you successful or happy. Mine made me successful and happy. I sense that's the same way.
It's exactly the same way, and as I said, 44 years this June, and, God willing, we'll keep on going together. It's great to go in this phase of life with somebody that you really like mm-hmm. and like to be around, and that you have respect for, and that that's mutual. I mean, it's just a real blessing.
All right. So following a marriage at the end of your college career and graduation, you embarked on your Air Force career. Tell us how that happened.
Well, off to pilot training, and by now I loved flying. The fact that it had military utility was interesting to me, but just flying was fun. And I thought pilot training was a great year, best year so far of my life. A lot of people really struggled in pilot training. I didn't particularly. I had the engineering background, so the academics was pretty, I wouldn't say easy, but easier. And apparently flying came fairly naturally because I didn't get too many pink slips, didn't fail any rides, and did well through pilot training. And did well enough to have a choice of what aircraft I got. Mary Jo had insisted, whatever you do, let's go back. I want to go back to Europe. She'd been there as a student, and she said, I want to go back to Europe. So it didn't matter what airplane was on the board there. I had to pick something that would take me to Europe, and I picked an F-4 Phantom, and off we went to Ramstein Air Base, Germany.
You're right that the Phantom was an especially challenging aircraft to fly. Why is that?
Well, I think it was, you know, it was big, it was heavy, it had a 2-person crew, and you know, the coordination required between 2 people in an aircraft like that it makes it a little bit more difficult than if it's a single seater. And then the missions it was assigned. It was assigned everything from air superiority to dropping bombs to nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Germany, we had to be qualified on all the conventional munitions, the bombs and the rockets and all that. We also had to be qualified and certified for the nuclear mission. And on top of that, we had, you know, an air-to-air mission as well. So physically it wasn't – I mean, it was a big brute of an airplane – but what made it hard was the many missions that it was assigned. And it just you were constantly, you know, running out of currency in one mission, having to catch up, and then you're behind in another mission, then you had to catch up. It was very difficult to set up a training regimen that would keep you current and qualified in all the many tasks that higher headquarters wanted you to be current and qualified in.
General, we have to pause now for another commercial break. We'll be right back. This is Jim Roberts, President of the American Veterans Center. The mission of the American Veterans Center is to provide an outlet for our nation's military men and women of every generation to share their stories of valor. From our radio documentary series, Veterans Chronicles, and our magazine, American Valor Quarterly, to speaker conferences and the annual National Memorial Day Parade along the Mall in Washington, D.C., the center is devoted to making sure that the public never forgets the service and sacrifice of those who have worn the uniform. To learn more about how you can support our efforts, visit AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Jim Roberts, and my guest today is General Richard Myers, and we're talking about his memoir, Eyes on the Horizon. General, you said that after a pilot training, when you went into active duty in the Air Force, your wife had hoped that your first duty station would be in Europe, and indeed it was in Germany. You write, though, that turned out to be a good choice in terms of career advancement. Why was that?
Well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, it was a good choice because we enjoyed our year and a half in Germany. But as soon as we got there, two things. I started out in the back seat as a pilot in the back seat of the F-4, which was
typical, right?
Well, it was typical for those days.
It's right. Not.
Right. Later on, they put navigators back there right out of nav school. But in those days, it was typical to put a pilot. And of course, what you wanted to do is upgrade as fast as you could to the front seat.
Exactly.
So, you know, you get there and you start talking to the personnel folks about when you might upgrade, and there was so much uncertainty because of the Vietnam War and people moving back and forth and all the turmoil associated with that time frame in the mid to late 60s that nobody really had an idea. But they said one thing for certain, if you volunteer to go to Vietnam, fly in Vietnam, that's a pretty sure way to get upgraded. So I hadn't been there, you know, but a month or two when I'm down in personnel saying, where's the volunteer paper here so I can volunteer to go to combat. I had thought early that if I'm going to go to combat, I'd like to go in the front seat of the F-4, not in the back seat.
Right.
And I wasn't sure I had that choice, but that was the way I was trying. So it worked out that as President Nixon, as part of reduction in our forces in Europe, we came back to Mountain Home for a while, and then I got to go to an upgrade program in the F-4 where I upgraded to the front seat, and from there to Thailand to fly in the Vietnam conflict.
Well, tell us a bit about that. Extremely trying circumstances for both Navy and Air Force pilots in that war in general.
Yes. It was the first time, basically, that we encountered not only an air-to-air threat from the North Vietnamese, but we also encountered surface-to-air missiles. These were missiles that were designed pretty much after World War II to deal with bombers that had been experienced in World War II. And these were then Soviet-designed systems. And while they were designed for bombers, they could have a pretty big impact on the fighter aircraft that were mainly flying in and the bombers that were flying in over Vietnam and Laos. And so, and then, of course, you always had the standard threat from anti-aircraft fire, the AAA. You know, as a captain over there flying combat, though, I'll tell you, you know, there are times when if you think about it very long, you know, you can worry about being shot down, about becoming a prisoner of war, and whether you're going to have the stamina and the fortitude and the perseverance to survive prisoner of war status. And as I read the memoirs of these folks that were held in Hanoi, You know, you never know how you're going to react to that. I was never convinced I would hold up half as well as those that did survive that terrible ordeal for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. Just awful. But that, you'd think about it then. But on the other hand, I mean, you're a captain. You're young. I had no children at the time. I did have Mary Jo as my wife.
Who came to Thailand.
She came to Thailand. She said, if you're gonna be put in harm's way, possibly die, I want to know what it smells like and feels like over there. And the Department of Defense had a prohibition against dependents, spouses, coming to Thailand because there wasn't any infrastructure to take care of them. And so I said, you can't come. The department doesn't want you to come. She says, you mean an American citizen with a passport and a visa can't come to Bangkok? And I said, well, I guess you can. She said, I'm coming. And so she came. She had, in the end, she had three jobs, all teaching, one at Chulalongkorn University, where she was teaching English to Thai students who were going to come on to the United States and pursue a master's degree and so forth. So she was well integrated into the community there in Bangkok. She didn't rely on any DOD resources whatsoever, and we would see each other then, you know, every couple of months we were able to get together. It was nice. I was threatened through that at one point that I'd be reassigned to Korea in a command post if I didn't send my wife home, and this was a little bit of arrogance because I said, I can't believe the Air Force would do that. I mean, I'm really needed here in this squadron. They don't have enough instructor pilots. I'm one of the few they have. I don't know how they could do without me. So I bluffed and somehow got by with my bluff. Knowing what I know now about the personnel system, that was a pretty stupid thing to do. I should have – I mean, I took a real chance there because that could have been a that could have been a career downer to go to a command post instead of flying combat. So,
But the gamble worked.
It was a gamble, and it worked. And I think back on it, think how stupid I was to take the gamble, but I did.
I'd like to mention one of your predecessors again, Admiral Moore, who was chairman during part of that period, and it was evident to me that he was very frustrated in the way that the war was conducted. What are your reflections on the way the
you know, as a captain, I reflect some of this in the book, but as a captain, I didn't get wound up in the politics of it or so forth. If the commander in chief said this is what we have to go do. That was good enough for me in those days. More importantly, if we, with our airplanes, were able to stem the flow of men and military equipment to South Vietnam and help our Army brethren out, that was also good enough for me. That's all I needed to know. And so I didn't think a lot about that. I did think about things like, and I talk about this in the book, those were still the days before this Goldwater-Nichols Act in 1986 that forced the services, Congress forced the services to work better together. It was before those days. So, you know, I think I talk about, I think the number 7 air forces.
Right.
You know, there's the bomber force, there's the airlift force, there's 7th Air Force in Saigon, there's a 13th Air Force in Thailand, there's the Navy, and there's the Marines. I mean, it was – and there's Army aviation on top of that. It was reasonably well coordinated, but not well coordinated. Everybody kind of had their own piece of the pie. In fact, they divided up North Vietnam to where the Air Force had certain route packs and the Navy had certain what they called route packs, which was primarily where they would fly. So it was not anything like today, and not as well organized and probably not as efficient. So I remember that part about it, the organizational part. On the other hand, it was exhilarating time, you know, for a young man, again, no children. And it was dangerous, but at the same time, exhilarating.
It was more dangerous, you're right, when you returned for your second tour of duty there in 72, right?
Right. We came back as what we call the Wild Weasel mission, which is to try to suppress or destroy enemy surface-to-air missiles. And at that time, the B-52s were starting to go further and further north. The first one that was shot down over the middle of North Vietnam, Route Pack 3, they call it, near a place called Vinh, I think, is where the SAM site was, or in that area. And our job was to try to suppress these surface-to-air missiles so they couldn't shoot down our aircraft. And those were usually 4 to 5 hour missions, several refuelings. We'd try to protect several different mission packages during those 4 to 5 hours, and often at night, which made it all pretty sporting. The good thing about night is that if a surface-to-air missile is fired in your vicinity, you can very quickly tell whether it's on you or it's on somebody else. And in the daytime, it's not quite as obvious, but at night, you see this glow from the rocket motor. And if it's steady on your canopy, if it's not moving on your canopy, that means it's on you. But if it's moving on your canopy, then that means it's on somebody else. And so you can quit, and you can see all the AAA that's fired. And you might say, well, I wouldn't like that. Well, you do like it because you can also tell where that's going. And you can it's easier to avoid or easier to know if you're under attack and have to take some evasive maneuvers.
You were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for your service in Vietnam. What was the specific incident that
both of my I've got two Distinguished Flying Crosses from Vietnam, and they were basically both end-of-tour Distinguished Flying Crosses if you accumulate enough missions and so forth. I never had one particular mission that earned it. And as I talked to our World War II friends, the B-17 crews and so forth that were 18, 19, 20, 22 years old, flying over over Germany, 12-person crews that would, you know, get shot out of the sky and then either become POWs or die in the effort. The things that they endured, I mean, I had it easy. I'm not, you know, that was sort of the standard thing we got when we left, but there was no single mission. It was an accumulation of my tour at that time. And a lot of air medals because in my first tour I was a fast forward air controller, in the second tour this wild weasel, and we accumulated because they were considered a little more hazardous than the routine missions. We accumulated air medals. We got an air medal for every 10 missions we flew in those two mission areas.
Mm-hmm. Following Vietnam, you were on, I believe, to Okinawa. Is that correct?
Went on to
two children. Your first two children were
right,
born.
Right. I had two children born in Okinawa. One before Okinawa reverted to Japanese control, and one after it reverted to Japanese control, also under President Nixon. And it's reflected in the paperwork for both of them. It's different paperwork. But that was a great place, a great base there at Kadena Air Base in Japan. Problem is, I was gone over 300 days a year, other places in the Asia-Pacific, while we were stationed there. So for the 2.5 years we're there, I'm barely home. I can remember one time having to take the airplanes and evacuate them to North Korea, or to Korea, to get them out of the way of a typhoon. And I call back. So I'm in this officer's club. I'm having a cheeseburger and a beer. And I call my wife down in Okinawa and say, well, how's it going? And she had one child in a crib, the other child in her arms. And you can hear the rain and the wind beating the shutters. She says, well, I think we'll be okay as long as I keep the mop out, mop this water, and I think we'll be just fine. And so there she is putting up with that. And I'm up there, you know, playing pool with the guys because we had to make sure our airplanes were safe. Unfair for sure. Yeah. But no, we liked our assignment there, and Mary Jo, I always say, well, we had a great time in Okinawa. Mary Jo says, no, you were never here. You don't know.
Right.
I had a great time, but you know, you don't have a right to even say because you were gone about 3/4 of every year. You were out of here.
Right. John, over the next 15 years or so, you had many duty changes, many promotions. I can't go through each one of these individually, but I'd like you to kind of walk us through this period and summarize, if you will.
I was really fortunate. After Okinawa, I got to go to Nellis Air Force Base and be an instructor at the weapons school. Out of there, was promoted to major, and I came out on the schools list, which was sort of surprising to me. That I guess about the top 10 or 15% of a promotion list goes on to advanced professional military education. So I went off to Air Command and Staff College, Maxwell Air Force Base, then to the Pentagon. I'd never been promoted early, but in the Pentagon, after a couple of years there, I was promoted early to lieutenant colonel, sent off to the Army War College. Really enjoyed my year. That was another great year in our career, was the Army War College. And from there down to Seymour
Johnson. What do you say that?
Well, because they were prepared at Carlisle Barracks there. In those days, the class came in, and the commandant stood up and said, listen, this is your year. If you want to do research on something that's just been nagging at you for a long time, we'll send you anywhere in the world. We'll give you whatever resources you want. The only requirement is if we're going to spend a lot of money on you for doing this research, you better produce the number of pages that would be equivalent to that amount of money. Or he said, if you want to just devote this time to your family because you've been too busy in command or whatever you've been, most of the people there had just come out of battalion command.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I just came out of a staff. Now, it was hard work, but it wasn't like in command. But so And it worked out well because everybody there was pretty much type A personality. So people worked very hard. But it was your year, and the whole college was set up to enable you to expand your professional competence or whatever you – I mean, you could do whatever you want to do. If you want to spend a lot of time on the golf course, you could do that. I can guarantee you very few people did that. But it was your year, and it was just – the Army did that just perfectly. It was very nice. From there, down to Seymour Johnson, very fortunate to get an F-4 squadron command, promoted to colonel and thinking, hey, my whole goal, my whole career is to be a squadron commander. I did that. Now I'm promoted to colonel. What in the world do I do? I had no goal. And so I'm trying to figure out what my next goal is, asked to come up and work in headquarters Tactical Air Command at the time at Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, in the personnel business. My best friend, he goes off to from F-4s. He got promoted at Seymour as well. He goes to F-15s, and I go to this staff job in personnel, which I'd never been in my life, and not into assignments, which is kind of semi-glorious, but to personnel plans and programs. I didn't know what I was getting into, and I thought, well, they're sending me a big signal here. It turned out, again, that was a great assignment. I worked with some wonderful people. General Billy Bowles retired as the commander of our air training command. General Norm Leasy retired as a 3-star, and he was working up in Office of Secretary of Defense when he retired. I learned so much about them, about how to take care of people. And then from there back to Commandant of the Weapons School back at Nellis, which was my first command, Tyndall Air Force Base, first wing command, back to Langley, commander of the 1st TAC Fighter Wing, where I was promoted to Brigadier General. And did a lot of jobs around Langley Air Force Base at Headquarters Tactical Air Command as a 1-star, moved to the Pentagon, promoted to 2-stars, and then up there nominated for 3-stars as the commander of U.S. Forces Japan, and went there. And I thought coming out of Japan as a 3-star, I told Mary Jo, I said, "Why don't this is such a fulfilling assignment we've just had near Tokyo here at Yokota Air Base. Why don't we just call it quits? Because I'm not going to get promoted again, so why don't we just quit and declare victory?" And she said, "I think there's more adventure." And I wanted to give her a chance to say, "Uncle, we've been doing this now for over 30 years. But she didn't say uncle. She said, no, there's more adventure." So came back. I was assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Shadi Kashvili, for a year, and then selected to be the commander of Pacific Command out in Hawaii, a 4-star position, then to Space Command and North American Aerospace Defense Command and Air Force Space Command back in Colorado Springs, and eventually as vice chairman and then nominated to be chairman. So that's a kind of brief synopsis. Every promotion over colonel was a complete – I mean, I just never thought
it was – a complete surprise?
Sure. And actually, it should be because that's the way the military is. But I sort of didn't expect it, matter of fact.
Well, very few make 4-star, let's say.
And I explained in the book that each one of these senior assignments, they kept saying, well, you're going to go to the Pacific Air Forces. And I remember General Ryan, the chief of staff, said, serve out there for – 3 years, but if you think you've done all you can do in 2 years, just retire. That's fine. And then I got to Colorado, and then they moved me to Colorado Springs. And Secretary Cohen said, "We'd like you to serve 2 years and retire." I said, "Fine." And then a little later, somebody called and said, "No, we want you to be there 3 years and retire." I said, "Fine." And so I was there a year and a half. And the next thing I know, I'm the vice chairman. And so you never know. And I'm not sure you should know. I think at that level, what's expected of you is to serve whatever the Secretary of Defense or the Service Secretary or your chief of your service wants you to do.
All right, General, we have to pause now for a brief commercial break. We'll be back for our final segment right after this break.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Jim Roberts, and my guest today is General Richard B. Myers, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and author of Eyes on the Horizon, serving on the front lines of national security. All right, General, we're now up to the beginning of your service as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. First question is, what is the relationship, legally speaking, first of all, between the chairman and the Secretary of Defense?
Well, Jim, it's one of the first things I looked up to make sure I understood what the legal obligations are. And the statutes call for the chairman to be the principal military advisor to the president and the National Security Council. And, of course, your immediate boss is the Secretary of Defense, who is a member of the National Security Council for sure. To go a little bit further, the statute also says that while you're the principal military advisor, as you advise people, you have to include the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so the vice chairman and the service chiefs of the various services. And if their advice differs from yours, you have to represent their advice. So if the Army chief had a different point of view, I'd be obligated to say, well, here's my point of view, but by the way, you need to know that General so-and-so, the Army chief, has this different view. Having said that, so I don't think in my tenure we never had one of those cases where I had to say, here's what I believe, but you need to know a service chief believes differently. We would work very hard at working through the issues, as you might expect, especially when the nation's at war, which it was as soon as I took over. I mean, 7 days after I take over as chairman, we're in Afghanistan. Basically, we're at war the whole time I'm chairman. We'd work very hard to make sure that the chiefs had worked through the problems where we could all agree on the major issues that we wanted to present to our civilian bosses. But that's the main. There's lots of other responsibilities the chairman has, but that's the main one. You're the principal military advisor to the and you're an advisor. The chain of command runs from the president to the Secretary of Defense to the field commanders. So you're not in the command chain, but by tradition, all the communication flows through the chairman to the field and back to the secretary. So you're well. You have to be well informed, and that's one way to keep you well informed.
Following up on that, one of your one of the chiefs was that you work with was General Shinseki,
mm-hmm.
Who was thought by some to have been badly treated because he gave advice on force levels that he thought would be required in Iraq that didn't sync with that of the overall command structure in the Pentagon. Your take on that?
Well, I cover this in the book, and he had, at the time, and it just came out maybe about a year ago or 9 months ago. A copy of the letter he sent to Secretary Rumsfeld after he retired, which explained that the advice he the number he gave in the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing was a number probably larger than required to give the Secretary and to give General Franks, the unified commander responsible for planning all the Iraq operations, enough leeway to do what they wanted to do. So I think it's been widely misinterpreted, misperceived about what he meant and what meant by it. And, of course, he was in all the discussions with the secretary and with the president as the president's asking us, you know, if we have any concerns mm-hmm. about going into Iraq. And we explained all that, and nobody had any concerns or any reason to not go with the plan that General Franks had developed. Now, it is true that there was real tension between General Shinseki and the civilian leadership in the Pentagon. I've been working now for several years trying to figure out, okay, what was the genesis of that problem? But there were some hard feelings, I think, that came out of the first Quadrennial Defense Review, and it colored the way I think he was perceived by the senior military leadership. That's really unfortunate. What was even more unfortunate, I think, and I cover this in the book as well, when General Shinseki had this Senate hearing where he was actually forced to give a number or felt like he was forced to give this number, he was criticized by the senior officials in the Defense Department. That is wrong. If a senior military person wants to give his advice, if he's in front of a Senate hearing, if you disagree with what he says, call him in privately and say,
right.
Why did you say that? I mean, you can't dismiss somebody like General Shinseki who has years and years of experience. He's battle tested, and you've got to listen. And if so, you don't do that in the public press. I think that was a huge mistake. And I told I think it was the time Secretary Wolfowitz.
I said, is when I recalled it.
I said you know, that was a real mistake. He agreed it was a mistake, but it was too late. You know, he'd already mm-hmm. been criticized. So that just kind of fueled the fire that was already going in terms of this relationship that had not been going very well. Now, it turns out that General Shiseki served his 4 years out, and I think did an admirable job and was at the forefront of transforming the Army to deal with the security challenges of the 21st century and get away from the Cold War paradigms.
As you mentioned earlier, within 7 days of your taking office as chairman, we were involved in Afghanistan, one of the most unusual military conflicts in American history. I mean, you write about Secretary Rumsfeld used to like to show these pictures of our forces. They're riding horseback, carrying this high-tech gear to call in airstrikes. And
when they asked for airdrop of hay and saddles, Western saddles, because these Tajik or whatever saddles they were on they're pretty made of wood and leather. They're pretty hard on your body. They said, "Hey, can you get us some Western saddles?" And my guess is a lot of those folks hadn't had any riding experience. I'm sure part of their training did not include horsemanship. Maybe it will in the future. But it was, I think, that model of linking up indigenous forces with small groups of special forces, with Air Force enlisted members there that had all the comms and the communications gears and the targeting equipment to call in precision-guided weapons, which kind of changed everything, to bring that air power to bear on this on the adversary, very powerful. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine somebody over there in Afghanistan who is they're used to fighting at fairly long ranges, not a lot of people getting hurt on a daily basis, and they said, you know, the Northern Alliance folks that we were allied with said, well, see that target complex? If you could take that out, that would be very helpful. And all of a sudden, from overhead, these satellite-guided weapons, you don't hear the airplane. All of a sudden, the thing, this weapon hits it, it disappears. And, I mean, it's almost like it's from God. And so I think it had a huge psychological impact on both sides, matter of fact. And it was a very powerful way to put our force together. So when Kabul fell, you know, we probably had less than a couple thousand troops in the whole country. And the Taliban, Al-Qaeda's run. The Taliban is run. A lot of them have been killed or captured. And we have an interim government, and on we go.
How about the, I think it was Operation Anaconda, where we tried to get bin Laden, and he escaped.
That was actually at Tora Bora.
At Tora Bora, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, yeah. Jim. You know, there's the Monday morning quarterbacks criticize, say, well, you messed that one up. I think General Franks's view was we've got a lot of al-Qaeda in the Tora Bora area. We don't have a lot of forces in country yet. If we wait to bring those forces in, which would take weeks, then they're going to dissipate. Mm-hmm. So we need to go now. And we had to rely on indigenous forces to some extent. We had small numbers. We probably had a big impact on killing and capturing a lot of al-Qaeda. The one we were really after, if he was really there, never know for sure. But he kind of escaped over probably into Pakistan, where I think most people guess he's still today.
Some have observed that so quick and decisive was our victory in Afghanistan that Secretary Rumsfeld's standing was sky high, and had he retired at that point, he would have gone down as one of the great Secretaries of Defense, but that instead, because of all the problems that ensued in Iraq, his reputation fell into disrepute in some sectors anyway. What's your take on that?
Well, a couple of things. Going into Iraq was basically, you know, Afghanistan was fairly popular. Iraq was not popular, although Congress did authorize the United States to go into Iraq. So I think Secretary Rumsfeld became the point person for the administration on the whole war, but particularly on Iraq. But he didn't have the authority over all the rest of the government to bring all instruments of national power to bear on the Iraq problem. So it became mainly a military effort. And clearly things didn't go exactly as some had thought.
That most thought, right?
I don't know. See, I think the military never totally buy into this idea. Well, the Iraqis are going to welcome us, and they'll take over their own affairs, and it'll all be flowers and hugs and kisses here. I don't think we thought that. Some did, and I think the flexibility of the military to flex through this period was probably one of the more important things. It was a difficult. Obviously, it still is difficult in Iraq. a very difficult period. But by the time I had left office, Iraqis had voted for a constitution at their own risk. Everybody remembers the blue fingers up. They had about ready to elect a parliament and then elect a government. They elected a parliament right after I left office, and then the government was installed early in 2006, in the spring of 2006. There was still the insurgency going on, and then, of course, in 2007, the bombing of the mosque in Samarra set off this sectarian violence that got way out of hand, and the surge ensued and all that sort of thing. So we know the story. But I think, you know, being the point person, Secretary Rumsfeld being the point person for the administration, putting him in a position when things weren't going well, that he would draw criticism. And that's unfortunate because he was a lot – he was very collaborative in working with his military, the military leadership, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the field commanders. You know, one of some of the conventional wisdom is if he just listened to his generals. Well, he listened to us all the time. Mm-hmm. And every decision he took or the president took was based on the advice we gave him. And we didn't – our advice – was not much different than the course that they chose. So it was the most difficult task I think this country's ever undertaken, is to go into a country like Iraq with the various factions. Al-Qaeda came to the sounds again, so you have to worry about Al-Qaeda in Iraq after a major combat as well. And it's just a very, very hard thing to do. The fact that here we are, almost 6 years later with a constitution, a prime minister that looks like he's doing a fairly decent job and has pretty good backbone, Prime Minister Maliki. It's been relatively successful. I think all the leadership in Iraq, though, says, hey, it could revert, so we've got to be careful here. But I think we're on a pretty good path there.
If I'm summarizing correctly, you were happy with the invasion plan for Iraq, which worked very well and. But you were uneasy about the occupation planning.
I was very uneasy because Central Command was focused on major combat, which is pretty reasonable. That's what we do best. But they didn't focus on what we call Phase 4, the stability and reconstruction. And the initial plan was for the military to be the provisional authority for some time in the future until it looked like we might give it either over to Iraqis or to a civilian provisional authority. But the decision was made in May, right after major combat. Iraq's pretty quiet. There's not a lot of insurgency at that point and not a lot of Americans or coalition forces being killed. And so we very quickly went to a civilian provisional authority with the idea that the Iraqis would see this not as an occupying force but as a group there to help them get back on their feet. And that's good rationale. But we found out as the year went on and as we get into the winter and spring of 2004 that the insurgency now is building, the Al-Qaeda is becoming more powerful. And in June of 2004, we take our military structure, which had been a three-star, and we place that three-star with a three-star responsible for the tactical operations in Iraq and a four-star to work with then our ambassador in Iraq. So we had to completely revamp the way we were approaching the problem. But that was, you know, we had to learn as we went. But, yes, I was not happy with the initial planning done by the military. I think there was a lot of planning done for the stability and reconstruction phase. It was in our execution, some of the leadership. I mean, it just didn't go very well, some of which I think I could have anticipated, not just looking back. But at the time, there's some things, as I mentioned in the book, some things I probably should have done that at least advice I should have given that might have made that a little bit better.
Final question. At the end of the book, you advanced some policy suggestions for reform in our national security system. You want to summarize some of those?
You bet. Well, it all hinges off the fact that I think we have a lack of a comprehensive strategy to deal with violent extremism. So I talk about what I call the global insurgency that we have with violent extremism around the globe, and then a strategy that we ought to develop and how we ought to deal with it, which basically involves all instruments of national power, not predominantly the military instrument, but all instruments. And then I talk about, Jim, the thing you ask about is how do we organize to do this? And one of the frustrations as chairman was the president would say, okay, go forth and do this mission. And it's a mission that requires not only the Department of Defense, but Department of State, Commerce, Treasury, Justice, many other departments and agencies in our government. But there's no way to harness all that power. And so think tanks around this town have been thinking about this problem. People a lot smarter than me about how we organize for this have thought about this. But we're basically organized by the National Security Act of 1947. And that was came about because of our experiences in World War II. So in a facetious way, we are perfectly organized for World War II. Now, we're a little better because we've modified the National Security Act, but we're still not, I don't think, organized for the threats we're going to face in the 21st century. My proposal is that we have more of a temporary arrangement to organize for major issues like Iraq or Afghanistan. Some people are calling for a fundamental review, which would require not only the executive branch but the legislative branch to come to terms on this. I think that might be too hard. I have a simpler solution where we've got to put people in charge that have the responsibility and authority to carry out the policy of the U.S. government and then can be held accountable. We really never had that for Iraq or Afghanistan or our global war on terror, which I call the global insurgency. You might say, well, it's Rumsfeld. Well, he never had the authority to tell the other departments and agencies what to do. He was held accountable, and I think in some cases mistakenly so, because – and the president can't be – he can't be the one that's responsible for the execution of this. So I have a solution there where the president can appoint somebody at cabinet level that would be responsible, have the authority, and be held accountable for mm-hmm. – and I've seen it before in the Clinton administration when I was assistant to the chairman. It worked out pretty well in Plan Colombia. President Clinton appointed Tom Pickering, who was the deputy secretary of state, to be that person for Plan Colombia. And actually, that was a much simpler task than Iraq or Afghanistan or global insurgency, but one that worked out fairly well because we knew who was in charge and who was going to be – who had the authority and who would be held accountable if it didn't go well. We never quite had that for the issues that we were involved in when I was chairman.
Interesting points, General. Interesting book. There's much more that could be said about this book. I found it a terrific read, a great story, and a challenging book in terms of the policy reforms you advocate. But we're unfortunately out of time, but it's been a great pleasure having you here as my guest. And
Jim, it's been great being with you, and I hope there's a lot of lessons learned in this book, obviously. And in the end, it's all about the troops. And one of the reasons you serve, one of the reasons I was privileged to serve as chairman is that, you get so much energy from those folks out there trying to do the job. And I never went to Afghanistan or Iraq where I didn't come back more optimistic and more pumped up than I did when you're out there visiting people actually trying to get the mission done. That's where it happens. It doesn't happen here in Washington, D.C. A lot of what I talk about is what happens here at the highest levels of government. But hopefully we represented our troops well because they're the ones that, in the end, get the job done.
Well, you mentioned our troops, and the fact is you were the number one in that chain of command, and I thank you for your service to our country, and I wish you the best in the book.
Thank you, Jim. Great to be with you.
My guest today on Veterans Chronicles has been General Richard B. Myers, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and author of Eyes on the Horizon, Serving on the Front Lines of National Security.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center in association with Pelcom Communications.